take someone else here. You've got your name on your tickets. Okay, then go in here. That'll be for the raffle.
On a fall evening, co-op members gather for their annual meeting. They look forward to an evening of good food, a business summary, and election results. A casual shopper will likely experience Twin Cities food co-ops as quirky, upscale health food stores. But it is this participatory democracy of the member owners that sets co-ops apart.
This is actually called co-op heaven around the country. There's no other place like this in terms of the way co-ops develop.
That was Gail Graham. Her position on the boards of several national co-op organizations gives her a broad basis for comparison. She's also the general manager at Mississippi Market, St. Paul's largest food co-op. Though Minnesota may be known as co-op heaven now, the movement grew out of a deep dissatisfaction with the 1960s status quo. And just as the movement was taking off, an intense internal struggle, now known as the co-op wars, threatened the entire endeavor.
It's hard to overstate how alienated young people were from the government and from the corporate culture and from every aspect of conventional American life. People were in shock about the war. It was like a violation of everything you believed in about what was right and how to live a life. Everything. These were revolutionary people, and they were anarchists. They understood what anarchism was all about. Anarchism was all about mutual aid.
Craig Cox worked on the co-op newspaper, The Scoop, and wrote the only book on the co-op wars, Storefront Revolution. David Gutnicht, who also worked on The Scoop, was very aware of the connections between the anti-war movement and the birth of the co-ops.
I got arrested and put behind bars for the completion of my draft resistance career while I was working at Mill City Foods, started my food co-op career. And the first meetings, I saw a lot of the same faces. They wanted to do something more than just protest the war and a draft.
Dean Zimmerman was an organizer and well-known personality on the West Bank of Minneapolis, the heart of the co-op movement. He later served on the Minneapolis City Council.
Now, it's important to know that at that time, there were lots of competing interests. Some people were interested in having cheap food for poor people. Some people were interested in having organic and natural foods for a better quality of food. Some people were interested in democratizing workplaces so that this would be a workers' co-op. There were a lot of anti-capitalist feelings, revolutionary. People saw the co-ops as an arm of building a greater revolution, not just in food, but in every aspect of our life.
Bob Malice was a co-op volunteer from early on and also happened to be Dean's roommate.
I mean, when I tell the story, talking about the food co-ops, that was more fun than a barrel of monkeys. But when I shift over to the co-op wars, then it's like shifting into like a color negative print where everything is different. You know, none of it's fun.
By 1975, the co-op wars would envelop the co-ops and buying clubs of the entire Upper Midwest, with the two sides competing for hearts, minds, and market share. In the Twin Cities, things got violent. But in the early 1970s, the atmosphere was friendly and casual. Bob Malice.
You work 3 days a week, make $25-$30 a week, live in a co-op house, make homemade beer, get high on pot, not much in the way of responsibilities, driving around, delivering bread. And, you know, you get a bus full of, three or four hippies and have the dog come along with you. It was a blast. I mean, we had just landed in this miracle.
Dean explains how the miracle started back in 1971.
There were these guys, Tom Quinn and Roman, who found this store on 22nd and Riverside and were planning to put together a co-op there. And we had a lot of meetings of people in the neighborhood in the People's Center, which was a community center. And then at the same time were a bunch of folks who had done a commune out in Georgeville, out in western Minnesota. And they were some of the pioneers in terms of trying to find natural foods. Well, that commune kind of fell apart and they drifted back into town. But they wanted to keep this food thing there going. So they started a thing called the People's Pantry, which they started it on Alvin Oderman's back porch. And it was a hit.
The Schroyer sisters, Debbie, Susan, Vicky, and Jeannie, along with Susan's husband, Keith Rona, brought commune health food to the West Bank through the People's Pantry.
And there was just, this was the beginnings of an awakening of a different relationship to food. We ended up moving the People's Pantry into the People's Center.
The People's Pantry was one end of the waiting room for the People's Center free clinic. So on one end of the room, they had tables set up, and they had an old kind of a scale for a grocery store. They sold brown rice and oatmeal and rolled wheat and molasses and raisins and a few kinds of beans, and that was about it.
The free clinic was just always totally crowded. The People's Pantry grew, and the list of items that were sold were huge, and so they started baking whole wheat bread, and people were eating whole wheat. When I moved to this town in 1968, you couldn't even buy whole wheat bread. Yes, that's how bad the food situation was. When the co-op came to fruition and they got the building all fixed and they're moving in there, we just picked up everything out of the People's Pantry and just moved it right down to the co-op. It was the existence of the People's Pantry that caused this first co-op, North Country Co-op, to have such an emphasis on organic food and natural foods.
North Country was so popular, within months, there were co-ops popping up all over the Twin Cities, with the largest concentration in South Minneapolis. Dan Nordley, who had just finished up high school, recalls the co-ops he biked past on the way to his summer job.
On this trip, I would go by Sap One, I would go by Greengrass, I'd go by Seward and North Country and Mill City Co-op.
Bob Malice.
It was this regional thing. I mean, somebody said that the Twin Cities co-ops did $1.5 million a year by 75. Maybe not a lot of money now, but it was like we thought we'd really struck it rich, or that we'd found this miraculous thing. But still, you wanted more because, I mean, it was so chaotic. I mean, our business practices were a joke. I mean, all these things were consensus collectives. No bosses. There's no bosses here. We just run ourselves. It's just us. And you would have a weekly potluck meeting to decide business by consensus. We had a rule where you could be no call, no show for a month and still have your job.
Bob's desire for more order, and more seriousness to the business of co-ops turned out to be a key point of discussion in the co-op wars to come. It was all part of an anarchist effort to make a community outside of the dominant culture. Craig Cox.
They were retreating from the dominant culture. It was, the whole idea was that they wanted to create this little bubble where they could do everything they needed to do, provide all of the staples of life, and build a community in which they could live and thrive.
Dean Zimmerman.
North Country rented a small building down the street, and we used that as a storeroom or a warehouse. We would buy things in bulk. You know, we'd buy like a half a truckload of raisins, 50 bags of whole wheat flour, and the other co-ops would come and buy those things from North Country. Then at a certain point, we sat down, and I sat down with a piece of paper and a pencil, and we just kind of divided North Country into two. Half was North Country and half was the People's Warehouse.
Annie Young, who later became a park board member and recently ran for statewide office.
I had started my co-op career out in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, where we started a buying club. And how I got affiliated with all of this was that we would drive up here back and forth to get our food from People's Warehouse. And then we were part of a larger group who said, we're tired of driving our old station wagons and pickup trucks and everything. I mean, at that point, everybody was hippies and had really junky vehicles. And here we are, lugging thousands of pounds of food in these vehicles and having breakdowns.
This burgeoning co-op movement quickly outgrew the ad hoc distribution center it began with. Annie Young, who drove from Sioux Falls, was soon able to rely on a delivery truck to bring in the food. She, along with Dean Zimmerman, Dave Gutnick, and co-op volunteer Chris Olson, helped get co-ops and buying clubs off the ground in rural Minnesota and the surrounding states. By 1975, she estimates there were around 300 in the network. The People's Warehouse was the hub. Meanwhile, some of the founders of the People's Pantry had returned to rural communal living. Not in western Minnesota this time, but at Winding Road Farm in Wisconsin. Keith Rona, Susan Troyer, and Bob Haugen were among them. It was at Winding Road Commune that Keith Rona and Bob Haugen met Theo Smith. Theo Smith was a charismatic African-American man with ties to the civil rights movement. He introduced Keith Rona and Bob Haugen to the works of Stalin, Mao, and Marx. Together, they studied the writings of these communist leaders. Soon, the three saw the co-ops as an opportunity for a revolution that went beyond food. They returned to Minneapolis and began recruiting. Chris Garwick was among the first.
I was asked to come to a, you know, would I be willing to come to a study group? And part of that was that I'd not talk to other people about the study group and that I not talk about who was there and what we were studying. It wasn't made clear that there was a bigger organization, but it was kind of obvious that there had to be something going on for there to be these requirements of secrecy around what was happening. It was only later that we named it the co-op organization, and that was when we went public and we had to have a public persona.
She was one of the few people who personally knew the group's leader, Theo Smith. Many didn't even know of his existence.
He had this aura around him, which I'm sure he cultivated, of, you know, that he was connected with the revolution, the countrywide, worldwide revolutionary movement. Seems, in retrospect, that he was probably more of a loose cannon. He had incredible charisma, came across as someone who was totally committed to changing the basis of how the U.S. operated.
Those outside the group who became aware of Theo Smith were suspicious of him. Many suspected him of being a government agent sent to sabotage the co-ops and the successful counterculture they supported. During 1975 and 76, leaflets and editorials flew back and forth, debating the direction of the Twin Cities food co-ops. One of the first and most debated pieces of writing was the Beanery paper, named after the Beanery Co-op, the first co-op to be controlled by the revolutionary group that now went by the initials CO. It accused the co-ops and co-op leadership of, quote, upper-class snobbishness, elitism, and upper-class domination of the lower class, and reminded readers that, quote, anti-imperialism was the motivating factor behind the creation of the co-op stores, which was certainly true of the co-ops that formed on Minnesota's Iron Range during the miner strike of the early 1900s. But what was the purpose of the co-ops of the 1970s? To change society or to make an alternative society? Bob Malice was also drawn in by what became the co-op organization, or the CO.
CO was a secret organization. The first rule was don't talk. Okay, so when I got pulled into a discussion group by my old friend Chris Garwick, still good friends with her, she said, Bob, here, would you like to go to this book study? Yeah, I would. Here, read this book. It's called Dialectical and Historical Materialism by Joseph Stalin. Now, there is a cheerful guy, right? After a few months of this kind of stuff, this intensifying debate, this criticism that was being brought to us and the food co-ops, that we were elitist and petty bourgeois, and that the counterculture thing was a bad idea, and the pure food line was a bad idea, I was getting pulled in. And then in May of 75, the People's Warehouse had a policy review board meeting.
The People's Warehouse was governed by the PRB, Policy Review Board, which had representatives from the different co-ops and buying clubs. PRB meetings were held quarterly. But day in and day out, the warehouse was run by the Warehouse Collective, which was mostly made up of CO members. Dave Gutnicht was a member of the PRB.
One of the things the CO was known for was sort of outlasting everybody else. In other words, they'd have these meetings that would go on for hours and hours, and people would drift away, you know, out of tiredness or frustration. So some of the policy review board meetings were sort of like that, and some of the individual co-op meetings were sort of like that, and that they basically just wouldn't stop, you know, until they had their way. Early 1975, as I recall, just at the brink of them taking over the warehouse, they had been attempting to argue their ideological point of view, and also attempting to show that the warehouse was being mismanaged. In 1974, the Policy Review Board meetings where this conflict was sort of developing and their faction was becoming more evident and their arguments were being pushed more strongly. And then in early 75, as I recall, it was a dramatic snowstorm, ice storm, and this Policy Review Board meeting was held. And that very next, I think that same day and the next day, it was when the CO was taking over physical control of People's Warehouse.
The warehouse takeover was the scariest thing I'd ever done. I was scared shitless. That weekend, I was told to go to a house someplace in South Minneapolis. We all got together to prepare our action, our response. And there I was in this house that was packed full of anxious people. And, you know, lots of buzz, you know, lots of, you know, drama going on at night. And Bob Haugen sees me on the phone. Haugen, who was like one of the mucky mucks, you know what I mean? He was like a lot closer to the leadership. Real sharp guy. And Haugen, you know, comes over to me and figures out when I'm talking to Zimmerman. And he gets me away from the phone and tells me, Malice, this is the struggle that's going to get harder and tougher, and you had better shut up. Where's that effect? So I was terrified. The rest of that evening, I just made up my business not to say anything. We drove across town to the People's Warehouse building at 26th and Stevens, and I was just focusing on not saying anything because I was so scared. Then we, you know, went in and took it over.
In the wee hours of May 4th, 1975, Bob Malice and other CO members took over the warehouse by force, wielding iron pipes. When the Policy Review Board members refused to leave, they were forcibly thrown out. Though there were no serious injuries, the co-op community as a whole was shocked.
For sure, it was a big turning point in my life. For the, you know, next 17 years, my commitment to the organization was like the center of my life.
Anarchists that they were, the PRB members were reluctant to call the police when the warehouse takeover happened, though they eventually did, causing more controversy in the community. After the warehouse takeover, there were several attempts to reconcile through negotiations and community meetings. Annie Young recalls the meeting the following September, where efforts to negotiate ended and the war began.
I remember in Sioux Falls, I had a new baby, but I literally hitchhiked at times back and forth to come to some of these co-op meetings. There were two kind of battles, the anarchists and Marxists, the natural foods and sugar processed foods. And it really wasn't about the foods. The one group went outside, formed a circle, did an ohm, and I read this message that I had written, a kind of conciliatory, negotiating, peaceful message. And everybody was rah, rah, ree. And a woman named Barb Jensen came up with the Emma Goldman statement, "If I can't dance, I won't be part of the revolution." And so some people went and made that into a big banner, and that became kind of the moment that the split happened, when I was recognized and read the statement, the banner went up, and, you know, the waters were split, and that was that. Then the wars actually began.
And I found myself in a situation where the fence that I'd been walking on ended. And there was no place to not be on one side or another, and I wasn't particularly interested in being associated with anarchists. And so I found myself in the camp of the revolutionaries.
Annie, along with many others, was shocked to find Dean Zimmerman on the CO side.
It was very difficult because most people believed in Dean, and nobody had any idea he was a CO. So when the split happened and he was on the other side, a lot of us lost faith and hope and were really pissed.
Though Dean didn't want to side with the anarchists, He soon found he couldn't side with the CO's revolution either. He ended up leaving the organization and saw the issue of what side he was on by leaving Minnesota altogether. The group under the banner was determined not to buy from the CO-controlled People's Warehouse and quickly formed an alternative warehouse called DANCE, Distributing Alliance of the North Country Cooperatives.
A bunch of people went to a house and started figuring out how they were going to get their food, because we weren't going to be getting food anymore from the People's Warehouse.
Having exhausted reconciliation with the CO as a possibility, the PRB took the conflict over the People's Warehouse to court, a controversial move for anarchists trying to escape the dominant culture. While the courts grappled with the question of ownership, the co-op war heated up on the street. Lynette, who later married Bob Malice, sided with the CO.
75, there'd been a big takeover of the People's Warehouse, and so I immediately got involved. Very soon, I found myself allied with the position that the co-ops, as I had been shopping in them, were restricted or elitist in the sense that the people who shopped there knew the ropes, they knew how to bring their containers. And my own mother, when she went to shop in one, felt kind of left out or not welcome, and I felt that it should be more available to a broader class of people, particularly working class and poorer people that were very much in need of cheap food and good nutrition. And so that's why I got on the side of the people who took over the warehouse. And it was on political principle that I made a pretty quick decision. And I think my first assignment was to be part of taking over the North Country Co-op. And that was not a very well-rehearsed affair, and I recall, getting ready to spend the night and occupy the co-op, and then very quickly we were ratted on by somebody who was at another co-op, realized what was going on, and the police came, and I can't remember if I was arrested, but we were routed out of there, or we got out of there quickly, and were not able to do the same type of takeover that happened at the warehouse. But this is all very exciting to me at the time because I felt like I was in a real revolution and we were going to make a difference in the cities.
A struggle for allegiance between the two warehouses began immediately. Dan Nordley, who was also involved in the DANCE warehouse.
There is a co-op dairy service that was CO, and they got into the back of the dairy truck and rode to Seward Co-op and threw out the two storekeepers, Leo Cashman and Chris Olson, kind of famous characters in this thing, and literally threw them out on Booth Street and said, "We're taking over the store." Seward is able to kind of get that one back, but later I think Leo Cashman became so incensed at that he got on this personal mission to make sure co-ops decided to incorporate so that when the police showed up and you said, "Well, who owns the store?" you could actually tell them.
Well, that's when I realized I had the mean old Mill City. Leo Cashman used Minnesota's strong existing co-op laws, set down in the early 1900s by Finnish immigrants striking against corporate-owned iron mines. Relationships ended, and families broke up over the co-op wars. At the height of the violence, a truck was firebombed. Most assumed the CO was behind it, though they never took credit. In most of the successful takeovers, the CO used a subtler approach.
Other places, it was more from internal argument. So in some co-ops, it basically took over by a process of gradually taking staff positions and persuading people to join their cause and making life unpleasant for those who didn't want to join their cause.
The non-CO folks fought back. Dan Nordley recalls what happened at the Mill City Co-op.
Another amazingly funny street scene was centered at Mill City Co-op at 26th and Bloomington, where the CO gathered 50 to 100 people to come march onto the co-op and take it over. Well, the rest of us rallied and went there and formed kind of this human barrier between the store and the CO. And the CO said, "Mill City doesn't serve the interests of the working class. You're so elitist, you don't have margarine."
In response, one of the employees threw out a box of margarine.
And then all the people that were lying in the co-op just kind of started in on this rendition of "Row, Row, Row Your Boat," to singing to the CO. It was quite funny. There were a couple of attempts on North Country Co-op where there would be a phone tree and a rallying cry, and if we got wind of the CEO trying to make a move on North Country Co-op, we just came and crammed the store with all non-CEO type people.
I asked Bob and Lynette Malis how they reconciled themselves with the CEO's use of violence.
I think about that often these days. I was reared with violence very far from my experience, but theoretically in my reading, the uprisings that were happening around the world were inspiring to me, and I realized that they were violent revolutions, and I didn't see how this country was going to change in a peaceful manner just through the voting process. And so I theoretically believed in violence, but I myself, personally, if I ever had been given an assignment to engage in that form of struggle, I would have just, I don't know what I would have done. I probably would have resigned.
Even Frederick Douglass, you know, power yields nothing without a demand. Theoretically, it was easy enough to grasp that. Violence is really, that's how the world changes. If that's part of your theoretical construct and you're in a total commitment organization, then the emotional violence that you're doing to each other, that you will inflict on each other and that you will accept in yourself, that was, you know, much more like the consequence of that. That's the way I look at that now. It's like the stuff you read about in Mao Zedong's China. That was our explicit model. So it's all criticism, self-criticism, and we had a whole suite of tools. Our ideological forms were based on our analysis of race, class, and gender. And then we would be led through this process of re-education to become like competent, reliable revolutionaries, professional revolutionaries in like a Leninist organization. You'd have a day job, and then you would have your programmatic work, and then you would have your collective household. So it was like a 24/7 thing. So you would have criticism and self-criticism on, so what's your mode of thought? Are you an idealist or are you a metaphysician? Is this your what's your ideological form? Like you say, is this your male chauvinism? So like you'd get stuff like, all right, you know, you burned the toast. So what's up with that, Bob? That's not an exaggeration. It was a meat grinder for relationships. We had an acronym, TSR, and it means tactical sexual relationship. So, all right, so you two, you know, go have sex and then write a report on it. And use the same revolutionary psychology to describe what's going on, right?
Bob and Lynette's marriage was arranged by the CEO. The fact that they left the CEO together and stayed together was extremely rare. When Bob and Lynette left in 1991, they saw the group as a cult, as did every other ex-CEO member I talked with. While the co-op wars were being fought on the street and in the scoop, the definitive battle was being waged in court. In the summer of 1976, the court ruled that the PRB, not the CEO, was the rightful owner of the People's Warehouse. The ruling ended the co-op wars. In the years since, the co-ops that survived and thrived have adopted many of the old CO demands regarding food and management. Now approximately half of all food sold at co-ops is packaged or processed in some way. The days of no bosses and lax accounting are gone as well. Interestingly, none of the truly CO-controlled co-ops lasted. David Gutnicht.
None of their stores stayed open, not that there weren't other co-ops that closed as well, but yeah, I don't think that they were in it to run grocery stores. They were in it to have grocery stores being a stepping stone or a recruiting and financial base for their Revolutionary Communist Party.
35 years after the co-op wars, there has been no sweeping political shift due to these unusual grocery stores. But their effects can be seen in almost any regular Cub or Rainbow, which now boast sizable bulk sections. Nationwide, organics are the fastest growing segment of the grocery business. Even Walmart carries organic milk. Over the long term, the hippies, anarchists, and revolutionaries that were so alienated by corporate America achieved both of their seemingly opposing goals. They made something for themselves outside of the dominant culture. And in the end, they also succeeded in changing the culture itself. This is Maria Omley.
Funding for Miniculture on KFAI comes from listeners like you and the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.